This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It is always happy hour somewhere, or at least that's what you told us.
Pretty much Friday, Saturday, Sunday, occasionally other times.
I drink about 2 glasses of wine or beer a week.
I have a lot of fruit that I grow. I often make wine.
I'm a beer drinker. That's all I ever drink.
When I get off at 6 in the morning, no matter where I am in the world at that time, could be Texas, could be Oklahoma, could be Louisiana, I go out and I try to find somewhere that's serving alcohol.
On Sunday, when we have our Sunday pasta dinners, I have a little glass of wine. And at book club once a month, I may have 1 or 2 glasses. But I generally don't drink beyond that because I end up crying.
My husband and I did not drink alcohol until our kids left for college. And then we took it up, I must say, with a vengeance. We thoroughly enjoy having a glass or 2 or sometimes 3 of wine in the evening, and it's something we really look forward to. I would not want to have to do without it.
According to the latest national survey on drug use and health, 70%, that's 70% of American adults drink. With that stat in mind, we're doing something a little different today. We're picking up on a conversation that was started by our public radio colleagues on the podcast Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC in New York. It recently had an episode called Bottled Up. Host Anna Sale asked Americans to think out loud about why they drink. The show got a lot of feedback, and it was far more nuanced than just drinkers versus teetotalers.
When I get to a place where I realize that, like, that is becoming my shortcut to self-care, if feeling buzzed at the end of the day is the only way that I'm achieving that personal space for myself, like, that's a problem.
I'm not an alcoholic. I don't consider myself an alcoholic. I like to abuse alcohol, but I don't have all the crazy symptoms of alcoholism and drinking to a bottom and, you know, everything that's associated with that.
I still want them to come over to my house, and I still want them to hang out with me. And it's so funny that I'm 34, and that is a worry.
Joining us now is Anna Sale, the host of Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. Anna, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
And at NPR in Washington is Jane O'Donnell, a health and health policy reporter for USA Today. Jane, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Anna, how did this episode of Death, Sex, and Money come about?
Well, it was a combination of things. I was on maternity leave earlier this year, so in my life, I am just getting back to drinking alcohol after my second pregnancy, where I abstained from alcohol for 9 to 10 months. So I've been thinking about my relationship to alcohol. And while I was out, we had an episode hosted by Jason Isbell, the musician, and he interviewed his best friend, Will Welch, who is the editor of GQ. And they talked about how they both came to deciding to be sober and to stop drinking, and that they decided to stop drinking kind of in different ways. And that led us to be curious to ask our listeners how they feel about their relationship with alcohol in their life. That was the question we asked. So we asked something that we hoped would prompt a little bit of reflection and not this sort of black and white storytelling that you often get when you are collecting stories about alcohol, the sort of big partying celebratory stories or the stories about how alcohol ruined your life. Those are both really legitimate stories, but we wanted to get a little bit more into the nuances of the choices people are making.
What about alcohol was on your mind, Anna, during your second pregnancy?
Oh my gosh. With my second pregnancy, more so than my first, I noticed after becoming a parent that glass of wine, after I'd worked a full day of work and put the toddler to bed, that glass of wine with my husband was something I really missed. And it wasn't just the sort of social aspect of sitting with my husband and talking, which is nice. It was also the effect on my body of the way it dealt with that sort of top layer of stress. It helped me let go of that. And so when I was pregnant and not drinking, I was like, whoa, I'm noticing this. I'm noticing that I don't have this tool and I have to create some other things to distract myself from this. I need to be more attentive to my exercise routines. I need to think about breathing exercises to do that de-stressing at the end of the day instead of just pouring that glass of wine. And that wasn't something that I was as aware of when I had my first pregnancy. The second pregnancy, I missed it.
Jane O'Donnell, could you tell us about what your relationship with alcohol is like? You've written about that in USA Today, right?
Right. And the reason I wrote about my own history with alcohol, which was that I quit drinking 27 years ago, and I'll get back to that in 1 second, is that I started to think about that more as I was hearing, while covering health, what the uptick was, that women in middle age in their 50s, what was happening to them. The deaths were way up. I was at an Association of Healthcare Journalists conference, and I was at two different panels. One was talking about how the deaths were way up. Another talked about how binge drinking, middle-aged people showing up at the emergency room with alcohol symptoms. And I don't mean people who were getting in car crashes, people who had to have their stomachs drained of the fluid from the really severe effects of alcohol. So that got me thinking, because I was shocked that people were still drinking like that. I was drinking like that in the 80s in Washington, when everybody was drinking at lunch and things were different. I just didn't think that kind of thing was still going on. And as an aside, two women in my hometown, my now hometown, I'm from Hamden, Connecticut, but I live in McLean, Virginia now, and two women also in middle age, quite frankly, drank themselves to death. So I wanted to examine, that would have been me, as I wrote in USA Today, had I continued drinking past when I was 32.
Jane, as you wrote, you've had some really, really hairy experiences related to drinking.
Yes, and so many people read that and had no idea. So it was hidden, like it is for so many women. I was in three different car crashes from the time I was 16 until the time I was 31. And back in the 80s, there wasn't the anti-drunk driving push, which, by the way, I ended up covering a lot of teen driving and drunk driving crashes as an auto safety reporter. But that wasn't really focused on that much in the 80s. So I had car crashes, and I ended up being, as I wrote, drunk on TV. That was my bottom. But I thank God that was my bottom, that I screwed up a TV appearance 27 years ago, and as opposed to hurt a child or, neglected a child, ruined a marriage, did any of the other kinds of things that so many people do, and I hear from people all the time. As with NPR, the stories on alcohol do incredibly well because it touches so many people's lives at USA Today.
We'll get to some of your calls in a minute, but Anna, I want to hear some of the conversations you had in Death, Sex, and Money. We played a quick clip in our intro of your exchange with a man named Drew. Here's a little bit more of that conversation.
I'm not an alcoholic. I don't consider myself an alcoholic. I like to abuse alcohol, but I don't have all the crazy symptoms of alcoholism and drinking to a bottom and, everything that's associated with that.
How do you think about that distinction, having seen alcoholism up close in your home growing up?
Man, that's a heavy question. I guess I never got quite to the point of, I was able, on multiple points to just kind of stop drinking when I wanted to, and just through force of will. And to me, I think that's a big part of the distinction, is if you can make a choice to not drink, then you are, maybe not as down that path of addiction. That to me is the marker of an alcoholic, or that's where I, draw the distinction.
Another clip from WNYC's Death, Sex, and Money. And I want to be clear, we're not just focusing on people who drink to incapacity or a loss of lucidity. We're talking about all kinds of alcohol consumption or non-consumption. But Anna, are we clear on where the line is between just drinking a little too much and alcoholism?
Well, that's what I found most interesting in putting together this episode. To be clear, the CDC makes a distinction between binge drinking, which is four or more drinks on one occasion a week for women, or five or more drinks for men on one occasion per week, versus heavy drinking. And that's sort of a drink or two a night for women. Eight or more drinks per week is considered heavy drinking. 15 or more drinks per week is considered heavy drinking for men. And the CDC says most excessive drinkers are not alcohol dependent. So if you are one of those women who has a glass of wine and maybe a little more so every night with your husband, you're in that danger zone of heavy drinking, where there are health effects. There are health effects when you drink any alcohol, but health effects of heavy drinking. You also, when you're drinking, are putting yourself and others at risk. So that was what was interesting to me, was there's this kind of line that people have in their mind of, oh, if I can quit, then my alcohol drinking is not a problem. If it's not something that I feel totally dependent on, or if I don't identify as an alcoholic, then I'm okay. And so this episode sort of opened up that question of like, maybe not. Maybe it's worth thinking about, you know, why you are drinking every night, or why you're drinking five nights a week, and what that's doing for you.
We'll continue thinking more about that with Anna Sale of Death, Sex, and Money and Jane O'Donnell of USA Today. And just to repeat that definition, binge drinking takes your blood alcohol concentration to 0.08 or more. It happens when, in about 2 hours, men drink five or more drinks or women drink four or more drinks. That's the CDC's definition. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment at your convenience. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit BetterHelp.com/1A to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
There's a multivitamin that can make our lives instantly better. All we need to get its benefits is to step outside.
Nature and parks and greenery helps us be our better selves.
The miracle of vitamin N, in the latest episode of our U2.0 series on Hidden Brain from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing alcohol, how we drink, when we drink, and most importantly, why. With that in mind, let's start in Albany, New York, where Anne is on the line. Hey, Anne, what's on your mind?
My mom could not get through a day without a drink. And even when she went through recovery programs, which she did several times throughout my life, there was not a day that she lived from the time she was 12, probably, that she could survive that day comfortably without a drink. She went through phases of beer. She went through phases of vodka. She went through phases of tequila, whatever she could get her hands on. And it was a need. It was in her system. It was not something she could kick, certainly not on her own. And there were times of her life when she was healthy and she was good, but it's a very delicate balance. You can get knocked back down so easily, so you have to have a support group who's there for you without judgment, who is willing to sort of ride that roller coaster with you. And it's tough, I will say, as a daughter, it was really tough, but I was with her to the end. And without that, I don't really know how long she would have survived. 63 is young, but I don't think she would have been alive even that long.
How did her drinking affect your thought process about alcohol? Did you ever consume alcohol, or what impact did that have on you?
I didn't start drinking until I was 28. And it was it was a little ostracizing in high school and college. I was nicknamed Sandra D in my high school because I didn't do any of the things that the other kids were doing. So it sort of made for an isolating experience. But I really wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to be my mother. And I remember the first time I ever got drunk, I think I was 30, and I cried because I thought, oh my gosh, here I am. I'm an alcoholic. I got drunk. That must mean I'm my mother. So I have, I guess, maybe consciously decided that that's not ever going to be something I want to do. I've only been drunk a handful of times in my life, and I don't miss it. I have a glass of wine with dinner. It's lovely. But that need is something that scares me. I'll be honest. It scares me.
What was your mother's name?
Catherine. I went by Kate.
Well, Anne, I'm really sorry for the loss of your mother, Catherine. I know that this is hard to talk about. Before I let you go, I want to get to a few more clips from Death, Sex, and Money. But for someone else who may be listening to this, who might be struggling either with a parent who seems to be kind of on the edge, or maybe a parent that they've lost, is there anything that your grieving process and your kind of growing process has taught you that maybe might help them?
It's not you. There's nothing you can do And there's nothing that you can do that will change them. They have to do it on their own. You can just support them as well as you can. But nothing you're doing or not doing is going to change their outcome. It is really who they are and the struggle that they have to go through themselves.
And I'm so sorry about the loss of your mother, but I really appreciate your courage and your willingness to share that story. I think someone out there is listening who can directly relate to what you went through. So thank you so much for just having the guts to call and talk about something that painful. Jane O'Donnell, I'd love to get your reaction to Anne's story, particularly watching someone struggle with alcoholism of that degree, to the point where it becomes a grave threat.
Yes, and it was so powerful. And the things that jumped out at me, I first went to the vision of a woman we've interviewed who's a member of our Facebook group, I Survived It, which has a lot of people who have lost family members to alcohol. Stephanie Logan Rice posed with her mother in the hospital as her mother was as yellow as I've ever seen anybody. Unless you see someone sitting next to someone who does not have cirrhosis of the liver, you just can't imagine how awful it looks. It was so hard for her and so hard for other young people I've talked to and heard about, teenagers who think that their mothers, in the case of the ones I know about, were mothers, didn't love them enough to stop drinking. And what really jumped out at me also that Anne said is that she couldn't get through a day without drinking, and then something, she would be doing better and something would get worse. So in keeping with your not preachy, the mantra here, I just think it's important for people to realize and do what Anna mentioned and try other things to kind of decompress, to de-stress after work, because I've talked to so many people who got in that habit who were not drinkers, but when they had small children, they started drinking a glass of wine while they were making dinner. And as life got more stressful, which it always does when you have children and families and jobs and the economy and all the other things that can happen, that's when so many people can turn into having a problem that they just can't stop. And to have your children see it through your children's eyes and the example you're setting.
Another aspect of this that came up in the call we just took had to do with this idea of social drinking, of the isolation that can come from not drinking, or I mean, also potentially from drinking to excess. That's something that our listeners brought up over and over again in a variety of voicemails. Listen.
Well, I rarely ever drink myself. I do understand the struggle that those with an addiction face. As an individual who has dealt with an eating disorder most of my life, I see the role that food and alcohol play in our celebrations, in events. Almost every aspect of our life revolves around food and alcohol. And when it's something that you are facing an addiction to, life becomes much more complicated.
Anna, I wonder what you heard from listeners as it relates to the social aspect, especially because there's this new trend of like bars that don't serve alcohol, of being like a sober millennial or seltzer parties or things like that. And I'm not even talking about parties for people, say, who are in recovery, but just spaces where one can consciously like avoid alcohol.
Yeah, I mean, there are those happening, but I think overall, our culture in the United States of America is very much revolved around alcohol. It's a date night if you have a candlelit dinner and a bottle of wine with your partner. You know, networking and professional events often are circle around alcohol. Even like fitness in some places, you know, the sort of like attitude of like, we're going to work out really hard and then we're going to run together to the microbrewery. We heard all of that from our listeners. And so that led to the question of like, who will I be if I stop drinking? Or even if I cut back, will then my friends think I'm judging them if they're drinking? Will they judge me if I say I'm drinking less and then they see me drinking? So that kind of peer pressure certainly was something that was on the minds of our listeners. That question of like, who am I and what will my life look like without alcohol? And so I think that the emergence of these spaces that aren't revolving around alcohol is really great, that you do have a place to go that's a that is sort of bar adjacent, that feels like a bar, but you can go and have a fancy drink with lime and ginger and whatever and doesn't have any alcohol in it. But certainly that's the exception and not the rule in our culture right now.
Jane, what does that happy medium often look like? Is there a sense of what it takes or what the linchpin is to having that kind of a relationship?
Well, I think it certainly is. It includes not needing to have a drink every day. And with the new research that I think is so important for people to focus on, that there is such a significant health downside. I was amazed when I did my reporting that 3 alcoholic drinks a week, just a week, gives women a 15% higher risk of breast cancer. So when you have those kind of statistics...
I'm sorry, say that statistic one more time.
So if you three drinks a week for women have a 15% higher risk of developing breast cancer, just 3 drinks a week. So there is so much more of a link to all different kinds of cancer, certainly esophageal cancer and all those other cancers, but breast cancer as well. And so I think when people certainly that idea that just one drink a day is when you get to the point where really that's heavy drinking, the happy medium should be socially if you can limit yourself socially. I was interested, and I'd be curious from Anna's perspective. I found when you're thinking about people that want to see who they really are, or you know how they would adjust. I mean, that's what's important. Go out and have club soda and see if you really like these people that much. My friends changed fairly dramatically back when I quit drinking. I mean, there's some people you hope that you can still get along with your friends when you're all sober. So that's the real you when you're not drinking. And if you're just not comfortable going out without drinking, you know, maybe therapy is in order. Maybe you have social anxiety or something like that, and best not to cover it up with alcohol.
Anna, what about them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's certainly true, that when you are having been pregnant 2 times in the last couple of years, like, yeah, you see it. You see what happens when your friends are drinking and how it's different when you're sitting on slightly on the outside of what's happening because you are abstaining. But I would say now for me, what I've found is like re-entering drinking. My daughter, she knows that my husband and I both have a cocktail and we call it a special drink. My husband's from Charleston, South Carolina, which is a real sort of like cocktail culture place. So we, you know, when we're visiting his family at home at 5 p.m., you sit down, you talk, you have a cocktail together, you begin to ease into the evening time. And so I've liked thinking of when I drink in that context of like, this is my special occasion time where I am doing this as a way of connecting with the people I love and being intentional about being in the same space together and being in conversation together, as opposed to, I think, what we heard from many women, including women of young kids, that it's this, as Rachel put it, one of our listeners, this shortcut to self-care, which is like, I'm exhausted, I just need to do one thing for myself, and the easiest thing to do is to pour yourself a drink.
Yeah, that idea of self-care came up in an exchange in the episode of Death, Sex, and Money between you and a woman named Rachel. Listen.
I sort of feel like pop culture in this moment definitely encourages me as a young mom to drink and indulge. Like, the idea that, like, that we need this, or we, you know, at the end of a long day, this is the way that we can, like, get in a bubble bath with Dove bars and a glass of white wine. Like, that's what we're supposed to do to take care of ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and it's just so easy to just pour a glass of wine and call it good. You know, like I checked the self-care box for the day.
Anna, what about that? This idea of self-care and alcohol. It sounded like in that question, it was something you'd already noticed and thought about. Were you remembering something specific?
Well, I just am like so just aware of the images in movies and kind of hip shows with young moms, with young kids. Like, it's all when they get together at book club, it's all about like the gurgling bottle of wine that keeps refilling the glasses. That seems very just sort of all over the place to me right now. And I think that there is like a little bit of that attitude of like, oh, you deserve this. You have been working so hard. And the thing that I loved about that conversation with Rachel is she goes on to say that her husband said to her, you know, you do deserve self-care.
you deserve more than a glass of wine. And her initial response was to be like, God, why are you telling me one more thing I have to do? She got really defensive because, like, when you're at your sort of like limit of what you feel like you can do in a day, that just feels like all she could do. But it has pushed her to think about, what am I doing when I pour this wine into this glass, and what could I do instead?
We'll have more in just a moment. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root. More information is available at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
The U.S. has the highest incarceration rate in the world, with 2.3 million people behind bars.
This week on Throughline, how we got here, the history of mass incarceration in American culture.
Throughline from NPR, the podcast where we go back in time
to understand the present.
Back now to our conversation with Anna Sale of Death, Sex, and Money and health reporter Jane O'Donnell of USA Today. Here is a message that was left through our app 1A Vox Pop from a listener in the San Francisco Bay Area.
My name is Brian. I'm from Hayward, California. My relationship with alcohol now, as I'm in my 40s, is just moderate. I drink maybe once a week at a few beers at a setting, or, you know, a couple of hard alcohol drinks. I think in my adolescent years through young adulthood, it was binge drinking and, you know, alcoholism, which is tapered down quite a bit as I've gotten in my middle ages.
Yeah, Brian, thanks very much for sharing your story with us. Let's keep going on the phones. In Indianapolis, Travis is on the line. Hey, Travis, what's on your mind?
Hi, Joshua. So I grew up as a member of the Mormon Church, and as you may know, their alcohol is completely against their code of health. So growing up, I mean, as a teenager, it was just very instilled in me that alcohol was the enemy. I mean, it was just very, you know, very indoctrinating about how, you know, the evils of alcohol, and knowing some people who were alcoholic, definitely drove some of that point home. I ended up separating myself from the religion a couple of years ago as a, you know, early 30s. And since then, it's been interesting. I mean, really discovering alcohol for the first time, as a fairly mature adult, you know, I'm definitely not drinking to get drunk necessarily. I'm drinking because I'm interested in it. I'm interested in the, you know, kind of the humanity of alcohol. I mean, you mentioned earlier in the show that alcohol is something that has been with the United States for years, but I mean, it's been with humanity for thousands of years. And so it's kind of been an interesting, foray into, you know, exploring the different kinds of alcohol, and it's become a fun hobby, I think, for both my wife and myself.
What's that learning curve been like, Travis? I'm sure there were some ups and downs along the way.
Sure. So thankfully, I got into it a little bit slowly. I really got into it just kind of drinking socially while I was out traveling with work. And so I'd usually be drinking with work colleagues. And I would kind of just pace myself to how much they were drinking. And most people at a work function aren't going to get, you know, extremely intoxicated. So really, I've been kind of I've benefited from not overdoing it too quickly. I've been able to pace myself. And so I've definitely been intoxicated, but I've never been, you know, just all out, you know, totally drunk, blackout, anything like that. So thankfully, that's been nice. But It has been interesting too, just kind of learning my limits, you know, whether it comes to number of, you know, number of beers, number of, you know, hard alcohol drinks, things like that.
How do you reflect now on what you were taught as a kid about alcohol? I mean, do you feel like you were deprived in any way?
Not necessarily. I mean, I know I've grown up to become a healthcare professional, and I know that one of the risks of alcoholism is having like heavy exposure to alcohol as a teenager, and maybe not having good boundaries set and things like that. So in a way, I'm kind of grateful that I've been able to explore it as an adult, knowing that I think I can be responsible. And I've been drinking now for a couple of years. I think that I have a handle on it. I don't foresee myself becoming, you know, an alcoholic that's going to ruin my life with alcohol. So in a way, you know, I have a couple of kids, and I'm kind of thinking in the future how I may introduce alcohol into their lives, and or, you know, allow that or have some kind of tolerance for it. And so it definitely adds, you know, there's some questions there. It's, you know, what is the right amount, you know, to be exposed to as a teenager? You know, if your parents let you have a half a glass of wine at dinner time, or, you know, as you move on into early adulthood, how you can kind of just, I guess, guide your kids in the right way so that they're not overindulging, but still able to have just participate in that kind of collective culture.
Yeah, Travis, I appreciate you sharing your story with us. And Jane, I wonder in the course of your reporting whether you found answers from people in general about figuring out that line, you know, that Travis was talking about, teaching his kids about it, where the line is between, and I'm being way too reductive here in saying this, but good drinking and bad drinking, or helpful drinking and unhealthy drinking. Like, have you come any closer to figuring out where that line is, Jane?
Oh, yes. Well, certainly, you know, is it affecting your life in a negative way? And you have to examine any aspect of it, whether it's your marriage, your job, your personal life, your relationships. But I loved that the caller was talking about, you know, trying to teach your children, you know, model good behavior. And I think one really important thing is looking at, are you celebrating everything with alcohol? Are you at home, you know, modeling that anytime anything good happens, alcohol has to be served? So that's a good habit to get out of, and condoning alcohol at an early age. There's been lots written about that, but it's showing that it's okay to drink. And that's for everything. And when it's illegal, is certainly not a good thing.
All right, let's see if we can squeeze in one or two more calls before our time is up. Here in Washington, Cole is on the line. Hey, Cole, what's on your mind?
Hi. I just had a couple of questions. A lot of the people that we've had call in today talk about their lives as heterosexuals and how drinking relates to that. I was curious if your guests had any insight on what it was like for gay men, you know, coming of age in a world and using alcohol as, you know, as a social lubricant, what it's like. How do we drink to put our anxieties at ease as we learn to be young gay men in college and even after, as we go out to experience the world around us?
Cole, that's an interesting question. And Jane, I wonder how you would respond to that. Also, particularly because many of the social spaces where gay men could congregate freely were bars and speakeasies. They were very private spaces.
Yes, and I'm so glad that was brought up, because I did talk about that and talk with Tom Hill, who identifies as being certainly in recovery and also a member of the gay community. He's a vice president of the National Council for Behavioral Health. He has said that it has been particularly difficult in the gay community, because just as both of you just said, that so much of the camaraderie, you know, when it wasn't as accepted to be openly gay outside, you could have the gay bars. But he said the kinds of things that are replacing that locally in Washington are like rafting trips, reading groups that are dry, other nights out that are built around people who share the desire to stay sober. There are also concerts, groups of people that are going to raves locally. Deborah Gordon, a woman I know who's with the ANOVA treatment centers in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. She said some of her clients who were getting drinking and using drugs, going to raves, are now attending them together. And then finally, Grateful Dead concerts apparently do have a place where they show a flag that shows where the sober people are standing.
And Anna, before we go, it just to speak to that intersection between alcohol and culture, even to the point where certain gay bars, especially lesbian bars in cities like San Francisco and New York, when they close, it's considered a cultural loss, not just a loss of a place to go drink.
Yeah, yeah. And in our most recent episode, actually, with the writer Michael Arsenault, he talks about going to his first gay club in New York City when he was a young gay man. He grew up in Texas, where his family was not supportive of him being gay, and how drinking and taking shots and getting on the dance floor, it was the first time he felt at ease dancing in his body, being surrounded by other gay men. And it was a really powerful moment. At the same time, his father has struggled with alcohol use, and so it's something that's on his mind as he continues to figure out young adulthood as a gay man.
Anna Sale is the host of Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC, a follow-up to the episode Bottled Up, drops on Wednesday. Anna, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
And Jane O'Donnell, a health policy reporter for USA Today. Thank you, Jane.
Sure, my pleasure.
This conversation was produced by Lindsay Foster Thomas, Paige Osborne, Orion Donovan Smith, and Catherine Fink, and it was edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.